From the Soto neighborhood of Seattle, Washington, I'm Chad Beter, and welcome to Defrag Tools. We are on location here at the Living Computer Museum. This is a really cool place. A lot of cool Microsoft history here. Thought this would be a good one to go check out after our tour of the Microsoft Archives. A little bit related, but some other cool stuff here that we don't have in the Microsoft Archives. So let's go on in and take a look. Okay, so we are here at the Living Computer Museum, Seattle, Washington, and here's our tour guide. Introduce yourself.
I'm Aaron Alcorn. I'm going to show you around some fantastic things.
This is the coolest museum. You know, one of the great things we were just talking about, every other museum I've been to like this, you know, there's stuff under glass. You can't touch it. You can look, and that's cool. But this, the Living, I guess, Living Computer Museum, it's kind of part of the name. The stuff here is working, it's maintained, and you can play with it. It's like the only place in the world where you will probably ever get to use a working Altair or, you know, any of these things, right?
Yeah, no, it's so exciting. People don't get the name until they get to the floor.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it clicks. Yes,
yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
I see what you guys are trying to do.
Yeah.
And they love it. It's
right.
Such a great experience. I mean, we've been open to the public almost 3 years.
Yeah.
And the response has been overwhelmingly positive. We are kind of hidden away in Soto, but some of the best things can be. It's worth coming down.
Kind of nondescript building from the outside, but just wait till you see what's in here. So it was the museum was founded by Paul Allen, right? Co-founder of Microsoft.
Yeah, it's started off as a website. The origins of the museum date back about 10 years. Mm-hmm. Started off as a website. PDP Planet was designed to give remote access to old Digital Equipment Corporation, or DEC, PDP machines.
Nice.
And then there was some interest on the part of some of the users to see some of the equipment, and then it have slowly evolved into a by appointment only museum, and then opened its doors to the public, as I said, just almost 3 years ago.
So very cool. A lot of Microsoft history here, obviously the Paul Allen tie-in.
Yep.
What do we have here? This is a kind of a unique piece, right? This is a PDP-7?
Yeah, this is a PDP-7 from 1964. This is the first thing you see as soon as you get off the elevator, and it is something else. It's a small computer from 1964.
Small,
for its time. would have cost about $65,000, which is cheap for a computer for its time, again.
Yeah.
But that's a lot of money in 1964.
Yeah.
That's about the, you could purchase and furnish three modest homes for $65,000.
Yeah.
If you like cars, you could almost buy 28 Mustangs.
Wow.
And then drive a different car every day of the month, provided that month was February.
Right.
But this was Harlan Lefevre's machine. He was a physicist at the University of Oregon. And you can see him in the photograph there with the pipe. He accepted delivery of this thing in 1966. He and his students completely rewrote the software, the operating system, everything.
Wow.
So it took about 3 years before it was up and running. And it was at the University of Oregon until 2006.
Wow, was it still running up until that point?
Absolutely.
That's incredible.
All their instrumentation ran into the 7.
Yeah. And it's here now, it still works?
And it still works. This is the only working example of a PDP-7 in the world. DEC only sold 99 of these, and as far as we know, there are 5 left, but this is the only one that works.
Amazing, amazing. That is
it's,
cool.
You know, it's our oldest working computer. It also has a really great story, and Ken Thompson at Bell Labs in 1969 wrote the first Unix kernel on a PDP-7.
On a PDP-7.
Which is the foundation of so much.
We were just looking at that. There's still all these, you know, papers sort of taped up to it that are, they look like they're about 40 years old. They're original, right?
Everything as we received it, we kept it.
Kept it. Amazing. Yeah.
And you can see the open cabinet there. You can see the hand-wired backplane there.
Wow. Super cool.
Yeah, it's a highly customized machine. This is lots of changes. You notice the blue box right there over the desk, that was their primary interface for the system. It's where they used it to log their counts, change output and display.
These big like chicken head switches, like I have on my guitar amp, right? It's amazing technology. So we've got a lot of great stuff here related to Microsoft too. You were showing me earlier, you've got a teletype over here and a great photo of Bill Gates and Paul Allen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Up here. Let's take a look at that. Look at these little kids.
Yeah, this photograph is from 1968. It's at Lakeside School. And this is the teletype room at Lakeside.
They had a teletype room at their high school. That's incredible.
Yeah, it provided remote access through a time-sharing service to a GE mainframe. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's something else. You just look at these kids. There's Paul Allen, 17, Bill Gates, 14.
Paul Allen with his sideburns, and Bill Gates looks like he's about 11 or 12 in that picture.
Yeah, no, I would check his ID.
For sure. That's so cool. And then you were saying that this this teletype here is actually connected up to an emulator of a GE mainframe.
Yeah, it is. It was connected up to an emulator of a GE mainframe. At the moment, it's not working. Everything's in a state of brokenness here. It's either broken, slated to be restored, or it's about to break,
and
we know it, or it's about to break and we don't quite know it yet. The living part of this, we've got an entire team of engineers who are working. It's their full-time job to fix everything.
And keeping this up and running.
It's a project. You'd think it would be a full-time job. It's actually 10.
Wow.
We've got a lot of really great experienced engineers who keep everything up and going. So
cool. So after the teletype, sort of chronologically here, what would be next in the history of Microsoft after Lakeside School?
Well, without a doubt, the Altair.
The Altair, right?
Yeah.
1975.
Yeah. It was designed in 1974. Around Intel's 8080 microprocessor, and it was featured on the cover of Popular Electronics, the January 1975 issue. And you know, with the promise, you could have your own mini computer for under $400.
That's pretty cool.
A bargain.
I mean, $400 even, that may have been more in 1975 dollars, but still, that's, you know, that's not bad, right, for a computer?
Much less than a comparatively priced mini computer, but you know, there was a catch, of course. You had to put it together yourself.
Of course. It'd be like you're gonna go buy your new MacBook, but you have to assemble it, right, or your new I should say your Surface book.
Exactly. But you'd have to put it together yourself, but it's not just screwdrivers. It's, you know, here's your soldering gun.
Soldering.
Good luck.
I was always mystified by these because, you know, I mean, I know computers, but I don't know how you would actually program a computer using lights and switches. That blows me away. But I guess a lot of people did, right?
I mean, as sold, this would have been your computer once you got it together.
Mm-hmm.
This is your interface, so all the switches are essentially binary, so if it's down, it's off, and if it's up, it's one. Mm-hmm. It's on. And now this is hexadecimal.
Uh-huh.
It's incredibly complicated.
To
do. You have to think in a different way. This isn't a natural language. You have to speak the machine's language.
Exactly. You're programming in direct assembly, and one instruction at a time, right?
Right. Yeah. Then you'd be depositing, moving on, so it takes a bit of time. Now, the Altair only shipped with 256 bytes
of
memory.
Wow.
So everything it did pretty slowly.
Yeah.
And then your results communicate by flashing lights.
And now eventually there kind of got to be a market for add-in cards.
The founder, Ed Roberts, who founded MITS and helped create the Altair, relied on an open bus system, which ended up creating an entire secondary market of other suppliers who would create different accessories, add-ons, all the rest. So
very cool. And you've got sort of Microsoft's very first product here, right? Which is Altair Basic.
Yeah.
Is this it?
Yeah.
We were just talking about paper tapes last week with Raymond Chen. And here's, look at this, Altair Basic. This is obviously not the original master paper tape, or you wouldn't have handed it to me, but
well, that's a good amazing thing. I drop it often.
Wow, that's so cool. So there's holes punched in it, symbolizing the binary. Oh, yeah. Well, here we are.
Yeah.
Look at that. It's amazing.
Yeah, if you just, there you go. It's a little easier to see right here. So each, if you consider that right there a line, if you have a hole, that's a one.
One byte.
And if there's no hole, that's a zero.
Right.
And that's an 8-bit byte.
Okay, so you'd have this paper punch card reader, not punch card reader, but a paper tape reader, and it'd be the same machine, I guess, to write and read the tapes, right?
It could be. I mean, this kit right here was $397, but if you want to run this program after buying it, you're going to have to buy other stuff.
Buy the tape reader.
Yeah, you're going to need a tape reader. You're going to need to have some kind of an interface.
Right, so you got a dumb terminal here. I assume they would have typically used either something like this or a teletype, right?
These would have been very expensive.
Yeah.
A teletype would have been more, probably more accessible,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
A lot less expensive.
Right.
The Model 33 teletype would have been expensive in 1975. MITS would have sold you one for $1,500.
Wow.
But that model had been out for probably 13 years, so you could definitely get a surplused one.
Right.
But surplused equipment was often damaged, so in addition to building your own computer, you're going to have to restore a teletype as well. But for that special someone in your life who wants to build their own computer?
You had to be hardcore to be a computer nerd back then. I mean,
absolutely.
You not only build the computer, but after you pay the $400, you're stuck using switches to program it.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you shell out thousands for like a keyboard and...
Yeah, it's you're all in.
It is.
They advertise it as a $400 computer, but it's really a $400 entry point into a much more expensive technical hobby.
Gotcha. Very cool.
But, you do have Microsoft just starting right here, which is fantastic. I mean, this moment, the Altair represents a moment when a lot of different things came together. You've got sort of a budding electronics hobby culture, you've got computing, you've got the 60s counterculture. This is a political statement as much as a computer.
Oh, because it's a computer that is yours to control.
That you could own. This isn't something that is representative of sort of the man.
Right. I guess that's true, because people back then sort of thought of computers as like big government, military.
Exactly, large corporations.
This is something a little different. It's counterculture computing.
For some, you could read with it. And then the start of Microsoft. I mean, this is a really early point where you actually have software being sold separate from hardware.
Right.
And this is essentially, if you think about it, this is a tool. This is a programming language that enables you to create more things.
So I guess that was kind of an innovation, because prior to that, either the software would have just been hobbyist written, or else the computer vendor would have provided all the software.
Right. Exactly.
Interesting. So Microsoft was a little bit of a maverick in that way, selling separate software for.
Right. Computer. Yeah. Absolutely. And really. Selling to anyone. Really open kind of philosophy. I mean, it ends up being that computing eventually does make it into the hands, as we know now, into the ordinary individual, but it didn't quite happen in the way that the sort of these early hobbyists expected.
Mm-hmm.
It's the marketplace that delivers a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
It's not free open sharing, although you do still have an open source movement.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
very vibrant.
Never going to go away. Hopefully.
Never.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, one of the things I was reading up on this, and I guess Bill Gates and Paul Allen, they didn't have an Altair when they were writing Altair Basic, So they were programming it using a simulator or something like that, right? A virtual machine kind of thing.
Well, they did.
On a PDP-10, is that right?
Yeah, it was a PDP-10 at Harvard.
Okay.
They first had to write an emulator to fool this mainframe into thinking that it was this machine, and then they could write their program for there. So there was many steps that went in the way. And actually, whenever they were still in high school, they had a small company that really failed, called Trafodata, but they made their first machine with that. And so that gave them the experience of programming, writing language for Intel chips. But yes, they did not have it. They were basically working off of the spec sheet that was provided by Intel.
That's impressive.
I think so.
For writing a program for a computer that you don't have.
Right.
That's pretty impressive.
It's a cool trick. It's a very cool trick.
You have a PDP-10 here.
We do.
Yeah.
Do you want to go take a peek?
Yeah, let's take a look. So here is the PDP-10.
Yeah,
this is crazy. Look at this.
Yeah, look at the size of it. This is a System 10, so it's a second generation PDP-10.
Okay.
It uses integrated circuits rather than discrete transistors.
Wow.
So,
very cool.
But yeah, look at the size of it.
Yeah, look at the size of it. And it's running here. We got a terminal hooked up.
Mm-hmm.
It is online.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of just blows me away. So there's like some of these cabinets have RAM in them, I assume. We've got some tape drives here. We've got CPU somewhere, I guess.
Listen.
That's all. I can't hear. That's all CPU. No,
all in the back.
Oh my gosh. Bruce is going to open this up. That is the CPU.
There's 1,400 cards like this.
He says 1,400 cards that make this.
On the back side of that.
That's amazing. How much RAM is in this?
Well, actually, we've got 3 megawords, but this memory box, near as we can tell, wasn't checked out right.
What? Okay.
And so, to talk to this machine, if we run all three, it gets confused switching between the megawords.
Oh.
So we only run one.
Okay.
And one is probably more than a working KI ever had. So.
Okay.
That's life.
That's amazing. Now, what am I holding here? I've got the
It's a flip chip. It's what pluggable circuit boards. DEC called them flip chips, sort of a technology that they introduced with the PDP-7, actually, which we started with.
Oh, okay.
So the idea is in the cabinets, you've got a hand-wired backplane. In the back, those boards would just be able to plug in. You could quickly change things out. If you had a bad board, minimizes the amount of service time, downtime.
So there are ICs on it, but these look like hand-drawn traces here.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's cool. Little bits of carefully narrow tape.
Ah, that is very cool. Using tape. Throw that back here. So, all right, so the PDP-10, which this is essentially what Altair Basic was developed on, in an emulated Altair. That is amazing. So people should come down and check this out. Check out the PDP-10.
Yeah, now if you really want to get your geek on,
we
do make many of our systems available remotely online.
Nice.
So you can get access to a PDP-10.
And over the internet.
The internet.
Old school.
Yes.
And you can hook up your teletype to it if you really want to.
Yeah. It's up to you. What you do in your home.
That's right.
No judgment here. Yeah. And we don't charge for this service. We just want people to use the stuff.
Very cool. So we'll put a link to that up on our website on the show here. So before we leave this server room here, this thing looks like it's the Starship Enterprise here. Are you kidding me? Control data, 6600. Now, this is a Seymour Cray thing?
Yeah, this is a control panel for the 6600. The machine you see behind us is a 6500. It was a slightly slower version of the 6600,
okay,
which from 1964 to 69 was the fastest computer in the world.
So, this was a supercomputer.
This is the first supercomputer.
The first supercomputer.
So the 6500 is really a value model.
A value model?
Yes.
Right.
About $8 million in 1967.
Oh my gosh.
Just a bargain.
That's incredible. And you were telling me that there are no ICs in this. It's all discrete transistors?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And hand-wired.
Yes, absolutely. This all would have been done by women. Do you want to get... Let's get close to it.
Oh,
come
sure.
On. You're never going to get a chance to get
go
this
go behind the velvet rope here.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
So, yeah, this would have been all done by hand, all by women. This is a handcrafted object.
Wow.
Making them one at a time.
Unbelievable.
High tech, but still handcrafted.
Yeah.
Now, they only sold about 100 of the entire 6000 series. This is the only one left as far as we are aware of.
Wow.
And we've been working for almost 2 years trying to fix it.
Wow. So. And you were saying it just booted up the other day for the first time.
Yes. We're getting
awesome.
An operating system. It's running an operating system called Kronos.
Very cool.
And which even sounds imposing.
It does. It sounds like it's, again, it sounds like something out of Star Trek. It looks like something out of Star Trek.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that same era, so I guess maybe that's where the Star Trek designers, like, they were probably looking at these.
And just thinking,
and going, well, that's what it'd be on a spaceship.
Yeah.
It's got its own air conditioning. Is this like a Freon tank over here?
Yeah, this is a cooling system. In order to restore this, we had to create all the necessary infrastructure. So we installed a chiller on the roof of the building,
wow,
all the plumbing. Water comes down here, goes through one of three chilling systems. The water is chilled to around 63 degrees, pumped through the machine, helps draw off heat, circulates back up to the roof.
That's amazing. I imagine all those discrete transistors put off quite a bit of heat. So,
yeah. And part of it is that it's so dense. Each one of these bays here represents a processor. See, we've got five.
These
six.
Are each a CPU core?
Yeah, each one.
Wow.
There are 10 peripheral processors. And the design was, the idea was that if you could dedicate a processor to a different IO device, you would be able to free up the central processor just to crunch math.
Very cool.
It's very neat.
Some incredible stuff here. And I love that the round screens on the console here, they're like radar or something like that.
Yeah, and they were repurposed.
Repurposed radar displays.
Stuff. Off the shelf, yeah, he was...
Very cool.
There's lots of neat stuff.
A lot of neat stuff here. So let's. This is awesome, and I had to look at it. Not directly Microsoft related, but that's okay because
it was
super cool. Maybe it was.
It's being owned. It's owned by Microsoft co-founder.
That's true.
Is that true?
So there's a connection here. Maybe it's not historically.
Or we're forcing it.
We're forcing it.
Let's
go back over here. All right. So. This is something I'm sure some of our viewers are old enough to recognize. I know I am just old enough to recognize these. Had a friend that had one of these. I think his might have had a hard drive, though it might have been a slightly later. But this is the original PC.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
From 1981.
Mm-hmm.
So after Altair Basic and probably some other basics,
yeah,
this was kind of a big one here.
Yeah, this is the point where... Before this, in the 5 years leading up to the PC, Microsoft was a languages company.
Yeah.
They supplied essentially BASIC to all sorts of manufacturers.
Really didn't have operating systems at first. Yeah, that kind of came
yeah,
later.
Yeah, that's
with this.
With this.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is a gradual expansion of Microsoft's aims and... sort of move away from just doing tools to actually creating an environment.
MS-DOS.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing's got dual, probably not even 360K floppy drives. Maybe they're 360K floppy drives. I'm going to pop the floppy out here. Look at this. Some of our viewers may not be old enough to remember these. DOS 2.10 on a 5 1/4 inch floppy. My son asked me, like, I had a 3 1/2 inch floppy. He's like, what is that thing? Like, it's a floppy. Well, why is it called a floppy? It looks hard. It was in a shit. These ones, you can see why they're called floppies.
Right.
But very cool.
Yeah, we've had some school kids ask us when presented like an 8 inch floppy. They're like, why did you 3D print the save icon?
The save icon. Yeah, right?
You cannot shake these things. I
think that icon for save will be around long after people have forgotten what a floppy disk even was. Right. It's like, there's certain things that just kind of hang on. Like, I know one of my friends had, her daughter was using an old school landline at the school or something. It was just all she'd ever used was cell phones.
Right.
And she's like, finish the conversation. She's like, Mom, how do I hang up this phone? Because there's no end call button on it, right? How do I hang up, hang up?
Right.
Kids don't even realize where that terminology comes from, right?
Right.
It's funny how certain things kind of...
It's just that you end up creating these things. I mean, even the beginning of Windows and sort of the idea of having a desktop.
Mm. Oh,
taking
yeah.
an old metaphor and bringing it current.
Right.
This is a point where computing is turning in above itself with the save icon. So
the save icon. Now, but this was obviously we didn't have. I don't think Windows would run on this thing. That came a little bit later.
That's
with
a
like the AT and the.
Yeah, we're a little later. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. But I do love these old IBM keyboards. I wish people still made them like this. The big. Heavy-duty buckling spring keys.
Perhaps a Christmas gift.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe you can still find used ones. They probably still work because they're built like tanks and they weigh about 50 pounds of solid steel in there.
So should we take a look at Windows 1.0?
Yeah, let's move on to Windows. We talk about Windows all the time on our show, so let's see where it all began. Do we have some old Windows here?
Absolutely.
Oh, look at this.
Microsoft Windows. 1.0.
Personal computer AT.
Look at you.
Yeah.
Attaboy.
Yeah. Now this one's still, maybe it's got a hard drive inside there, mm-hmm. but it looks like dual floppies and black and white CGA screen probably. Mm-hmm. I'm dating myself that I can recognize that just from looking
color.
At that. Color. Oh, it is a color display. Mm-hmm. It's just Windows is in black and white.
Well, it's...
Well, as I remember, CGA had like two modes, and the only way to get color was go to super low res or something. So probably to be able to get high res enough to get decent amount of text on there, you had to switch it to black and white mode or something.
Right.
But we've got a mouse. And this, look at this, a Microsoft mouse. Mm-hmm. This is the original Microsoft mouse.
Right.
Wow, even before what we called the Dove Bar and some of those later mice, this is that blocky looking. Original one.
Yeah, and mice are really interesting because this is the point where the design hadn't been stabilized yet. So with Macs, for example, released in 1984, it was a single button mouse.
Right.
With the Xerox Alto, which it basically inspired all of this stuff, it was a three button mouse.
Right.
So.
That's amazing. But you know, as old as this is, it's still, you use it pretty much the same way. I mean, I'm starting to feel a little bit more at home here.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely.
It's Windows. It's kind of ancient, but it's still Windows.
It's not as pretty, but.
Yeah. Now, which version of Windows is this? Is there an about on here? There must be special. Oh, man, maybe not. I don't recognize it here, but.
I believe this is 1.0.
1.0, which sort of had windowing, but barely from what I remember reading.
Right.
I never actually used 1.0. I think I came in a little bit later than that, but very cool. But we had, this is kind of also where we had the software suite idea. So you had your clock and your calculator and your little lightweight word processor. Right.
This is, again, Microsoft shifting, started off as a languages company, moving into operating system, and here we've got applications.
We've got our calendar here, so this is sort of, you would have this in your phone now, but back then, had it on your desktop, one screen at a time.
Yeah.
Cool. And we've got a little bit later version of Windows over here, I think we can look at too, right?
Sure. There's a version of Office Professional.
Oh, Office Professional. Oh, look at all these floppies. Oh, man.
You know,
I remember having to install programs off of, you know, 37 floppy disks.
Right. I mean, this is a reason to phone in for a pizza.
Yeah.
Order Chinese and just get to work because it's going to take
forever. Inevitably, you'd go and you'd install your software, whether it was Windows or Office or whatever,
sure.
And it's like, please insert disk 3 of 37 and you know, come back in 3 minutes for the next one. And inevitably, you would get to disk 36 out of 37, and it'd be a disk read error, because floppies were notoriously unreliable. There'd be a bad sector on the disk or something, and you've just wasted your entire day. You can't finish the install. Mm-hmm. And so when I first started at Microsoft in the late 90s doing support, we still had people installing off of floppies, and occasionally we would have to, like, we'd get those calls, like, I'm on disk 36, and it won't. And we were, all right, give me your address, and I'll send out a whole new, and we'd send them a whole new big box of floppies, replacement media.
Right.
So thank goodness those days are over. It's a little bit easier now.
But, I mean, can you imagine all the shelf space?
Yeah.
I remember working at an Office Depot. Whenever Windows 95 came out.
Yeah.
And it was such an event.
Oh, yeah.
Such an event. Because this is the point where you really, I mean, this is where when the Windows environment becomes so much more exciting.
Do we have that here? Windows? Let's keep on progressing through the years
sort of
here. Jumping ahead of ourselves. This one, oh, look at this compact. Oh, it's not. Oh, it is on.
It's asleep.
They actually had power management by now. Look at that. The CRT slowly warming up here.
Mm-hmm.
Old Trinitron. Man, these were the best monitors. Trinitrons were what you wanted. Mm-hmm. And this looks like Windows 95. Look at this. And it's running in safe mode.
Someone last night must not have turned it off correctly.
You would get that warning, too, if you shut it down wrong. I guess you still do sometimes. Like,
yeah.
Windows didn't shut down correctly. You want to start in safe mode. And now we're into, like, colors, you know, 256 color graphics.
Yeah, and you've got, you know, an object-oriented display so that this is becoming more and more familiar.
Yeah, definitely starting to look more like the Windows people know and love. This was the first time we had a start button.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we got away from that a little bit for a while, and people complained, and it's back now, but there you go, the very first start button.
Yeah, well, I mean,
Microsoft.
I think people may have complained only because they're so familiar.
Yeah, you know you're used to it.
You can't, if you're leading the dance, you can't suddenly switch partners at the last minute and
that's right.
Walk off the floor. You know, we need
that's
a little
right.
help.
Very cool. And a little bit newer, this is the one of the better mouses, I think, that we had. Mm-hmm. That one was very nice. No mouse wheel yet. That hadn't been invented, but it had a nice ergonomic curve to it. And now I think we've got some other copies of later versions of Windows here, it looks like. Maybe
yep,
Windows
absolutely.
98 here, possibly. Is that?
This is ME.
Windows ME. We were talking about that with Raymond last week. The one everyone likes to forget, but there it is. You can come to the Living Computer Museum and play with Windows ME. What do we got here?
I'm not sure what's going on here. Well, it might not be a total loss because...
Is this Bob?
It's Bob.
We have Bob! See if Bob will run. We'll see if Bob will run. Run, Bob, run. Oh, there he is. Microsoft Bob. This one's an ill-fated kind of thing. You know, we were talking about Bob. I was talking about Bob the other day with somebody, and you know, it was a failure at the time because it just, you know, people thought it was silly or whatever. You got the little dog here, which, by the way, that dog didn't, there were, that's sort of the ancestor of your Siri and your Cortana and, you know, this sort of, these user agent things now that you can ask questions. And, you know, it was a little bit maybe ahead of its time. The technology wasn't quite there what it is mm-hmm. now, but that was the idea, right? You have these sort of characters in the computer that you could interact with, and that was the first idea.
Right, right. Or the paperclip.
Clippy was
just the idea that you're trying to make these things a little bit more user friendly,
more humanistic.
Soften the edges a bit,
right?
That if you're going to be spending a lot of time with these things, it should be a pleasant experience. Perhaps they weren't able to deliver with Bob. But it was an experience.
It was an experiment, and it wasn't a total loss, I think, but they probably learned some things there that that got integrated into later products with the online help and some of that early sort of natural language kind of interaction that is now sort of becoming better and better now with the newer stuff with Cortana. Cool. And we got a whole corner of cool Microsoft gear over here.
Yeah, this is a cabinet. The case is here. This is all Microsoft hardware.
I got one of these mice right now. That's in my laptop bag.
You know, starting with the Microsoft soft card.
We were looking at
1980.
This. Now, when we were in the archives last week with Raymond, we were kind of going through some big drawers, and they have these sort of silk screen designs for circuit boards. And one of them kind of looked like this, although this, I thought at first this was an 8-bit ISA card for a PC, but it says here it's actually for an Apple II.
So that it was enable running CPM.
CPM, which was another operating system that kind of contemporary of DOS, or maybe a little ahead of DOS.
Yeah.
And you could run that on your Apple II. Mm-hmm. Oh, this actually has another processor, a Z80 on it.
Yeah.
So sort of... sort of an early kind of VM, I guess, idea where you've almost got two computers in one. You can switch between.
Kind of a dual boot.
Dual idea. Boot. Dual boot between your 6502 Apple II based processor and your Z80.
Yeah, and you can see all the various.
The easy ball. Oh, we got a lineup of the mice here. Mm-hmm. Everybody's, I don't know. I think everybody that works at Microsoft has their favorite version of the Microsoft mouse. Mine's the IntelliMouse Explorer 3.0. I still use that at home. Got the cord on it, but it's a great mouse. Very cool. And we got some keyboards. Now, this is crazy. A Microsoft cordless phone. Mm-hmm. I had no idea Microsoft made a cordless phone. Unbelievable. I don't know what made it Microsoft. It must have had some software interface that, you know, voicemail, I don't know.
I couldn't tell you, to tell you the truth. It's because they screen printed.
Yeah, it says Microsoft
on it.
This looks like something I'm going to have to research because I only vaguely remembered that there even was a Microsoft phone. We got a Zune here.
Which, sadly, we just learned that Microsoft is no longer going to support the Zune.
Oh, that's too bad.
We do have someone who works here who still uses and loves her Zune.
They're great. You know, Zune got a lot of hate and, you know, people made fun of the Zune. And I get why. It was late to market, I guess, compared to the iPod. It kind of missed the boat. But I had one. I loved it. I thought the UI on it was fantastic. It was like, what it did, you know, being a music player, it did very, very well.
Right. Well, devices fail not because for technical reasons, but because of social or cultural reasons.
Yeah.
The fact that they were so late to market.
Yeah.
The goalposts were moving, and it's hard to play catch up.
I think that's very true. Yeah, I think that may have been what happened there.
Yeah, that's why it ends up becoming more essential to start thinking where things are going rather than where things currently are.
Yeah.
And you're starting to see that now. We were talking earlier about the
The Surface Book. Surface Book. I feel like Microsoft's definitely taking the lead on a lot of that kind of stuff now. With a lot of the new hardware that's coming out, it's really a little bit ahead of the curve, and they're doing a lot of great innovating.
Right.
And not just sort of playing catch up like the Zune was. Yeah.
Yes.
Cool. We got the force feedback wheel here. I had one of these. I wish I still had it. Although I think it had a game port interface rather than USB or something, the one I had anyway. So it probably wouldn't work on my PC anymore. It was probably why I got rid of it. But, but it was great for racing games. Xbox 360, everyone knows those.
Mm-hmm. Yep, there's the first Xbox right there.
Oh, we got the original Xbox here. Introduced 2001. Man, I logged a lot of hours in Halo on that thing. We got an old tablet here, motion computing, 2004. So this is this an XP tablet? It kind of looks like.
Yeah,
it's got an XP sticker on it.
Yeah, so
it doesn't want to come up here, but.
It'll wake up.
Okay.
It had a hard night, it was out.
Yeah, motion computing has been one of our longtime partners in that sort of high-end tablet space.
Look at this. I'm shutting it down. But.
Oh, Windows XP Tablet Edition. So long before tablets and touch became a thing, this was kind of our entry into that market. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you can see the progression there, Surface RT, and then the Surface Pro 3, which is by far the best of these three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it almost feels like we might need another space right here for more.
Surface Pro 4, Surface Book.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. Perhaps just send along two so that I can spend time with one as well.
Yeah, very cool. And we got a Kinect over here. So a lot of this stuff, more current. So I like that you represent the whole history of, all the way from the Altair up to the new stuff.
Mm-hmm. And so. Of course, with everything constantly changing, you're always, the way that the exhibits are currently are not the way they're always going to be.
Right.
Always going to have to reincorporate new things, reinterpret everything in light of changes. So.
Very cool. Well, there's a lot of great stuff here. We didn't even get to show you everything. There's a lot of non-Microsoft related stuff here. You've got a Xerox Alto.
We've got a Xerox Alto. We've also got a Xerox Sigma 9, which was a Xerox entry into the mainframe computing business with the division called the XDS division, which was probably so efficient at losing money. but the Xerox Alto, so many firsts with that. Just an
first
incredible.
GUI, right? That was kind of what the.
Yeah, production. Graphic user interface, production mouse, sort of the early sense of the desktop metaphors formulating there, cut and paste functionality with a mouse, Ethernet networking, it just incredible.
Nice.
And
there's one here. People can play with it.
Soon. Ours is currently having some issues with its motherboard and a bad IC, but we are
working
on the
it.
Way. We have two Altos. We will eventually get them both up. And because they were meant to be networked, we will be able to come and play two-player games together with a friend. So it should be a great experience.
That would be great. Well, people should definitely, if you're in Seattle, if you visit Seattle, come check out the Living Computer Museum. So much cool stuff here, hands-on. You can play with whatever you want and whatever's up and running at the time. It's a big process keeping all this old hardware up, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But the resources that you guys devote to this and the full-time employees that are here, just dedicated hardware engineers. And
We currently don't have a volunteer program. This is all staff.
Nice.
So this is a really Paul Allen's sort of embrace of this idea. I'm trying to connect people with the past. The idea of maybe to nudge and encourage them to start picking things up in the future. So it's really a unique experience.
I was psyched when I walked in here. It was like, computer geek heaven for me. I'm like, oh my God, it's Altair Basic and I can type and program it and that. Like, when there's nowhere you get to do that. So
where in Seattle can you program your own souvenir punch card?
Ah, souvenir punch card.
I do not know.
Never even used a punch card reader yet. I'm going to have to go do that next. All right. Well, thanks for watching, and we'll see you next week. If you have questions or comments, put them in the show notes down below or email us at defragtools@microsoft.com. And thanks again, Aaron. It was awesome. Living Computer Museum, SoTo, Seattle. We're right near the Starbucks headquarters. We're between Starbucks headquarters and the Safeco Field, pretty much. So come on down, check it out. Very cool. Thanks for watching.